Welcome, everyone. Today is March 21st, 2017. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Got another full agenda. We're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2010 and invite up Madam Speaker. Cassie, could you review the bill?
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2010 establishes the Task Force on Addressing Racial Disparities in Home Ownership to compile data concerning levels of home ownership among people of color in Oregon. The bill directs a task force to identify barriers to home ownership and access to mortgage loans, investigate practices and procedures for approving mortgage loan applications, identify practices and procedures deliberately discriminating against people of color, and recommend solutions. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage, and the task force sunsets December 31st, 2018. We have the dash one amendment for consideration, and the dash one amendment changes the appointment of members outside the legislature from the governor to the president and the speaker, and changes the staffing of the task force from Housing and Community Services Department to Legislative Policy and Research Office. We have the fiscal, and the fiscal just clarifies that there would be budget allocation but no additional cost, and there is no revenue impact.
Okay, Madam Speaker.
Good morning. Good morning, colleagues, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Speaker of the House, thank you for entertaining an amendment to House Bill 2010. The dash one is super simple. After the first hearing with Representative Bynum and I, we looked at this and decided it would make more sense just for simplicity purposes to have this be a legislative task force. It would still go to Ways and Means. It is a task force. But this would just put the purview under the legislature if the Ways and Means decides to move it forward. So I urge your support and adopt the amendment and move it to Ways and Means if you so choose. Thank you.
Hey, Vice Chair Olson, can I have a motion?
No.
I see in the morning.
Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2010.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the dash one amendment dated March 15th, 2017 into House Bill 2010. Is there any discussion? All right. Is there any objection? All right. Then the amendments are adopted.
Hey, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2010 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2010 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? All right. Then can we please have a roll call?
Representative Corsick?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Paluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Pegar?
Aye.
Good deal.
The bill passes. Would you like to be the carrier, Madam Speaker?
It's going to Ways and Means.
Oh, I'm jumping ahead. Jumping ahead. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Great. We are going to close the work session on House Bill 2010, open a work session on getting ahead of myself there. 2964. Representative Smith-Warner and Cassie, could you please read the bill? Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2964 extends city approval of applications for limited property tax exemption to existing single-unit housing that is purchased, rehabilitated, or newly constructed. The bill is effective the 91st day following signing day.
Thank you, colleagues. Thank you so much for having me here today. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith-Warner, and I represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I am here today to talk about something that you guys talk about all the time and to present a potential other little bit more for us to work on the housing crisis that you are dealing with every day in every way in this committee. We've all heard the stories from our communities. Up in Portland, I know a number of you were at a listening session that the Community Alliance of Tenants had earlier this year. The chair and I have both worked on buildings where folks are being wholesale turned out. There is clearly a housing crisis both in Portland and across the state. And one of the things that I believe everyone agrees on is a big part of our problem is we need more housing. We have a supply eye problem. And so House Bill 2964 is a small attempt to do what we can with the tools that we already have to increase that supply. House Bill 2964 builds on an existing program that promotes affordable home ownership, and it's called the Home Buyer Opportunity Limited Tax Exemption. And because everyone likes a good acronym, the acronym is HOLTE, H-O-L-T-E. So HOLTE, the way it is currently structured, allows a city to adopt and implement a limited tax exemption program for low and moderate income households to purchase a newly constructed affordable single unit house. So the issue is, so this is something that's been used successfully in the Portland area, and the problem is, with decreasing amounts of new houses being built and the opportunity for the construction of new houses that are in the affordable range, the idea is, why don't we use this same incentive for to give folks the opportunity to purchase already built houses, and specifically for folks who already live in houses to be able to rehab them and to get a tax credit for both buying an already existing house in this affordable within their parameters of income, as well as rehabbing houses for seniors and other low-income population who are in a home and need to rehab it to some extent in order to keep them in that home so they can continue to age in place. So far, Portland implements HOLTE through an agreement with Multnomah County, and these changes would provide additional local options for promoting affordable access to and stability in home ownership. I am not going to talk broadly about the details because I believe there is someone else who can talk more to the specifics. I hope I'm not. I'm trying to look at the analyst there to make sure I'm right. But I just think, I think we all agree. We talk a lot in here about what can we do to afford. There's a lot of other things we talk about on the renter side, and this is another thing on the ownership side, that another small expansion of an opportunity to help increase that supply of affordable housing. So I hope that you will give it your full consideration and pass it. And that's all. I'm willing to take any easy questions.
Two other people testifying on this, so you can spare her if you wish.
Yes. Yeah.
I was going to ask a question, but it's not easy, so.
Okay. You'll have to wait for the other testifiers.
Yeah. Glad to help out, though.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all.
Smith Warner. Okay. Can we please have Elizabeth Edwards and Andrea Mathiason?
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland, and I'm here today with Andrew Mathiason, our Neighborhood Housing Program Manager with the Portland Housing Bureau. So very quickly, understanding you have a lot on your plate this morning, so we'll try and keep our comments brief. I want to thank Representative Barbara Smith Warner for her leadership on this bill. At its core, House Bill 2964 is really about creating more home ownership opportunities. And to date, the successful HOLTE program has been focused on helping low and moderate income home buyers purchase new affordable homes. So given current market conditions, it's important to expand this program to look at not just new, but also existing homes. House Bill 2964 would create opportunities for low and moderate income home buyers to receive a tax exemption in order to purchase an existing home, and it would also allow for low income homeowners to receive assistance for home rehabilitation, as Representative Smith Warner referenced. So these two additions to the HOLTE program will help expand eligibility and help low and moderate income households both access and maintain the benefits of home ownership. So with that, I am not the issue expert. Andrea is the issue expert. We have a very brief PowerPoint, so I'm going to turn it over to Andrea.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here. I'm here to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2964. My name is Andrea Mathiason with the Portland Housing Bureau. Portland has been administering this homeownership opportunity limited tax exemption in its current form since 2012. Previously to that, the program existed in a variety of iterations for approximately 15 years or so. So we have kind of broad experience with the issues that come up in administering this program. Statute allows for local jurisdictions to design a program as long as builder applications come in prior to development, as long as the sales price cap on the single homeownership unit is below 120% of the county median sales price for the previous calendar year. In Portland, that's $416,000 annually. Portland has, as statute allows local jurisdictions to do, imposed a set of additional criteria on the program. We use a sales price cap that doesn't use the fully allowed 120% cap. Ours is set at 100% of median sales price, which is $350,000. We've also imposed income restrictions on the buyers of these units to determine their eligibility. 100% of median family income or area median income. So in Portland, that's $73,300 annually. And the reason that Portland imposed a lower sales price cap was to attempt to align this program with other home buyer education, counseling services, and other closing cost down payment assistance that's available to HOPE in an attempt to kind of layer those resources and those subsidies to get lower income households into homeownership. I think it's important to note that the benefit of this program goes to the low and moderate income home buyer. It's not a benefit that goes to the builder or to the developer. The benefit is not financial. It's really one that allows them to have a marketing tool to reach a broader potential pool of buyers. And so as the housing market in Portland escalates, the motivation and the incentive to the builder to work with the program has been declining in recent years. This is a valued homeownership tool. I think Representative Smith-Warner really touched on homeownership, and it is one of the primary ways that low and moderate income households build wealth. Their access to homeownership and their ability to retain that homeownership is their primary tool to be able to build wealth and pass it on to future generations. And that's a very important strategy for getting families out of poverty. In terms of the foregone revenue of this tax exemption, for the 14-15 program year, Portland approved 111 of these tax exemptions. The estimated foregone revenue for that very first year of the 10-year tax exemption was about $126,000. Local jurisdictions are required to approve by 51% of the taxing jurisdictions the program. And so the city of Portland has done that in partnership with Multnomah County. We've established a cap of 100 approvals annually in order to restrict the foregone revenue associated with this program. As you can see from this chart,
can I just ask you, 100 sure. total or 100 new every year?
It's 100 new every year. And that 100 unit cap does not apply to nonprofit developed units, I should add. So as you can see, when we started administering this program in 2012, Portland didn't have a difficult time hitting that 100-unit cap. And in fact, we frequently approved those 100 units in the first several months of the program year. In the past couple of years, that approval rate has declined. And so you can also see that the average sales price associated with the program has increased, but that the average income of the buyers has not increased. And so that really just kind of paints a picture of affordable homeownership in Portland anyway. And it also, I think, helps to solidify one of the reasons that Portland is hoping 2964 moves forward. The current program and the requirement for new construction in the current market anyway is becoming less of an effective tool. And so For a family at 100% of median income, they can afford, using general mortgage calculators, a mortgage of about $275,000. So when you compare that with the sales price cap of the current program, you can see that discrepancy. The builders build at that top end of the cap, even though Portland is not using that full 120%. And so we would like to be able to provide our first-time low and moderate-income homebuyers with a broader, larger pool of affordable homeownership opportunities to access by using hopefully a revised statute to purchase existing inventory in the real estate market. The expansion that we're proposing simply allows for home buyers to purchase existing inventory. That gets at the excess piece. Retention is equally as important as accessing home ownership, and the ability of a homeowner to access home repair assistance to address emergency and critical home repairs gets them part way towards their ability to retain their home. But frequently what we find is that it's difficult to justify public investment in home repair if the homeowner is financially vulnerable and we are not insured of that long-term ability to retain their home. The tax exemption could be envisioned to go hand in hand with home repair to help both maintain their ability to live safely in the home and maintain that structure, as well as their ability to maintain that home financially. Statute requires local jurisdictions to approve that program with a certain set of parameters. Portland would likely impose criteria to help support the most vulnerable homeowners, both in terms of the access homeownership component of this proposal, as well as the retention and home repair component of the bill. Probably looking at households below 80% MFI, or in the case of home repair, even below 50% MFI.
We have 2 minutes left for this.
And I am wrapping up.
Okay, good.
And I think at that point, I think I would just say thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of this bill and ask if you have any questions that I can respond to.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly to understand the process, would the buyer have to identify a home that they want to have rehabbed, or would a builder actually, when you said something about application, maybe that was the old program, but would the builder be the one that has to apply for the tax exemption?
In the current program, the builder does have to apply. The homeowner has to be income eligible. In the proposed revision to the statute, the home buyer could come to the Housing Bureau or to the local jurisdiction, and with a home identified, they could also be under sales contract so that you can determine the sales price of the unit.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
And
thank
in
you
terms
much.
Of the home repair, I think then it's an owner-occupied home repair program currently. Those resources that are allocated generally are for low-income homeowners, and then this would work in conjunction with that.
Thank you. Follow-up. Sorry.
Okay, follow-up.
I guess because the process, we want to incentivize contractors to maybe take a blighted home that's in disrepair, repair it, bring it up to a market value that's within this parameter so the buyer can buy it. So I think it's going to be, I don't know if we've thought through this to make sure that we're incentivizing construction companies or builders to go in and rehab some of these homes that are out there and then offer them for sale. So.
Chair Representative,
for a remodeled home, existing market stock, yeah.
The purpose of House Bill 2964 is getting at a slightly different section of the market. So it's as far as the repairs, it's looking at specifically for those folks that are in their home and stabilizing in their home to make sure that they can stay there. And when it comes to expanding the program from new homes to the existing market, it's not tapping into that same body of properties that you're discussing.
Okay. Just trying to understand it, but thank you.
Yeah, and happy to follow up afterwards.
Okay, thank you. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions about your implementation. Am I reading correctly that households must be below 100% of the AMI for the full 10 years? And then if they do not occupy for full 10 years, is there a penalty? Or is there some payback?
Thank you for the question, Chair, Member. The current implementation of the program is that the City of Portland does quarterly compliance monitoring to ensure that the property is owner-occupied, that it is not rented. There is not an income requirement associated with the specific household for the 10-year period. It is terminated at the point in time it's identified that the household is no longer living in or is renting the unit.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So if you have any follow-up questions for them, please contact them separately just so we can move on. Thank you so much for bringing this. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2964. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3005. Rep. Hayden, please. Oh, and Rep. Parrish as well on this one? Great. And then, Cassie, could you please read the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3005 creates a refundable credit on personal income taxes used for eligible rental payments if an individual makes at least eight months of rental payments and has a household income not exceeding 300% of the federal poverty guidelines. The bill applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2018 and before January 1st, 2024. The bill is effective the 91st day following signee die.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs Olson, and Sanchez. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative from House District 7. It was a pleasure to serve on this committee last time around. This time we're off to more health care issues. The concern that this bill addresses, or the problem that this bill addresses from a different angle than what I think has been looked at in Oregon historically, is housing. Housing, we agree housing is a crisis in Oregon, whether that's in Portland, or whether that's in Klamath Falls or Malheur County or wherever. It's pretty universal that housing has become a significant problem for all of Oregonians. And so we need to take, in my opinion, a multiple facet approach to creating solutions within housing. And so I did a national search over this summer trying to figure out what can we do in housing, thinking that I might be back on this committee. what can we do in housing? And I came up with a couple of unique ideas that are out there. Maryland has the idea of a rental credit or a deduction on the taxes, and Minnesota also has a law. So this law or this proposal was loosely modeled after Minnesota and Maryland that have done this. The concept is if we are able as Oregonians to go out and buy a home and have the fortunate ability to do that, we're able to deduct our home interest mortgage and basically invest in our home. Other than perhaps our businesses, that's one of the biggest investments and is the biggest investments that people make towards their retirement in most cases is their home. If you aren't fortunate enough to be able to kind of get over that critical mass of being able to go out and get a home loan and purchase a home, you rent in most cases. And if you're renting, you're not investing in yourself. You're investing in the landlord's property. You're investing in your family from the aspects of you have a roof over your head and you have shelter and a place to sleep and hopefully you can afford to keep it warm. But you don't have the opportunity to invest like if you are a home purchaser. And so I wanted to look at what other states do as far as a rental credit or a deduction. Being from Oregon, we do things a little bit different here. So the Maryland plan allows for 15% of homeowners to deduct or to have a tax credit of their rent, 15% of it, and they cap it at $1,000. The Minnesota plan uses 17%, and they cap it, and they have some kickers in there, so it increases with inflation, so it's a little bit over $2,000. When I asked LC to write this plan, I said, I want to target this at what Julie and I, Representative Parrish and I, call our anti-poverty bills, meaning that we target bills at people of 300% of the poverty level and lower. If you look at our Oregon Health Plan population, 40% of the people that have Oregon Health Plan have jobs also, and many of those rent, and they're within that 300% or lower poverty level. And so this bill is open to amendment, but it is set at $2,500 that you could get on a tax credit. It is also refundable, and so people would be able to offset some of the expenses that they have for their rent that they can invest in themselves with the idea of eventually getting them to home ownership. Sadly, I think it's appropriate for us at the legislature to remember this last winter. We had Karen Batts, 52-year-old in Portland, lost her life due to exposure. David Guyatt, Mark Johnson, Zachary Young, same story. And what we did was we proactively, in those cases, opened warming shelters. I think it's time that we take more of a we retroactively opened warming shelters there in Portland. We need to take a proactive approach to this. We need to look at it from both angles that would help to support housing, help to support people that invest in their families and themselves to be able to just make that little bit. What if Mrs. Batts could have had that $83 a month on her copay paid for her, right? This bill would do that. This would, the Section 8 people that have a very small burden to pay on their own that their subsidy doesn't pay for, I think it's time that we take a look at stepping in and making sure that the minimal amount of people that can be able to have housing. We want the maximum amount of people to have that housing and the minimal amount of people possible to lose that housing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Kindergeyer, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. And I appreciate that Representative Hayden drafted this bill, asked me to be a sponsor with him, because I think housing is absolutely critical. It is not only the piece of our lives that kind of keep us whole during the regular day. It is having stable housing is what breaks poverty cycles. This morning, I was talking to a mom who's got two kids graduating from high school who rents, and we were talking about the dual credit that her child, both of her boys have earned, and that she couldn't pay for those credits, and that to get those same college credits, because she didn't have the cash to pay the $150 a class, going on to a four-year university or community college, we're talking about thousands of dollars of debt and lost credits. And so for me, when I think about what having extra cash flow in your life looks like, $2,500 extra dollars in your year to be able to make those incremental purchases that pull families out of poverty, to me, that's really critical. Some years back, House Republicans worked on a package of bills designed to put some jobs into the system. And one of the things that we scored was a doubling of the tax brackets, and that would create for folks on the lower income spectrum, that would create thousands of jobs in addition to putting more cash back in people's pockets. And so when we look at something like this as a way to not only help the issues that we're having around high cost rents, but that we're also putting money into the economy that's being spent in the economy that does eventually come back to us. We're an income tax state. So when I look at tax credits, and people sometimes get a little sideways on tax credits and we're giving away government money, it actually comes back. I would have a different conversation if we were in a state like Washington that does not have an income tax. But when you actually move those dollars and you show how they come back in the second and third tier economic impact, they will eventually come back to the general fund. It's why I also don't have heartburn over things like prevailing wage, because eventually those dollars actually do come back into our general fund. And again, if we were not an income tax state, I'd have maybe a different philosophy. But since we do have a 9.9 income tax, these dollars do come back when people spend them out in our economy. So to give them into people's hands who need them at the time that they need them, I think is really critical, because it is about moving people incrementally out of poverty. And again, Representative Hayden talked about the bills that some of the bills that we focused on, where we are trying to figure out how do you lift people out of poverty? How do you create tools that move the dial for people? This bill is one of those things that we think is one of those tools that would make an absolute impact into people's lives. So we hope that we get a chance to get this scored. I think that's an important part of what we do, is asking LFO to show the analysis of not just what does this do for the individual person, but that piece about what does this do for the economy, because I don't think we create fiscals the right way around here if we don't show all the downstream impacts so that we can make a decision. We make decisions based on a two-year sort of biennial, this is going to cost the government something, instead of actually looking at what it does when you put these kinds of dollars in the economy. You put them in people's hands when you need them, and we do know that a safe home leads to home ownership. We were renters. We were on Section 8 growing up, and I can remember the first day that we bought our first home. I was 23 years old. It was a big deal to suddenly actually have a place that was permanent and that was my own. And this type of bill, whether it will lead people to be able to save for that first home, save for that down payment, or just even make rent this month. And so we do think that focusing on that 300% of poverty is an important piece of making sure that there is a way for people to stay in their homes. I was horrified when we read the stories this winter about people dying in the streets of Portland. I was dismayed when I called one of our state agencies and asked for a list of our open buildings. It took over a week for them to get back to me in the middle of a snowstorm. So we have to do something more around this. This could be one of those tools. And lastly, I'll say, you know what? I know that there's some other bills about how do we deal with landlords and tenants. But if we're going to make housing a priority for as out of this body, we can't just put it on the backs of landlords. We have to collectively say, as a body, as a state, we value home ownership. It's a right. We think people should have a place to live. We value the ability for someone to have a low-income affordable rental. Collectively, as a group, we have to pay for that, and we have to make a decision to pay for that. We can't just ask one part of the population, one cog in the industry, to pick up the tab. So if we value that, then we need to start valuing bills like this so that we say collectively it's something we're all going to do together.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Chair.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. So I have a constituent who's been trying to get me to sponsor a bill like this. You guys are a year ahead of where our conversations are. And he runs a property management company, and his theory, now all the property or the landlords that I personally know are good people and they do what they're supposed to do. That being said, his theory is that this would actually not cost us much money. He's run into a number of landlords, these are his claims, that are requiring cash payments and therefore are not actually claiming their revenue or their income on their taxes. And so his belief was that if we did a bill along these lines, that it would offset by, you would actually be able to track better what was being reported by landlords. Have you guys seen any data that would validate or discredit something along those lines?
Thank you, Member Stark. I have not seen, I think what you're referencing is the cash industry of rental homes without going through taxation and being reported. This bill would indirectly address that, because many of the folks that this would help rent those homes, and they have to report that. We did not put the burden on the landlord to report that, because we wanted the individual themselves to be able to report what that rent was. Therefore, we felt that we might get a more honest reporting of those rents. And so that, and we have a request to the Department of Revenue in this to adopt the rules, giving them leeway to do that so they could connect those dots together.
Representative Stark, I would add that I'm open to the idea. We've obviously not talked about this, but I'm open to the idea of putting in a component that sort of adds the documentation piece. So even if it's the renter just simply getting a rent receipt, and then you can cross-verify that, well, landlord's only accepting cash, renter has receipts that clearly show cash, landlord didn't claim that cash on his income tax, and that you have a way to sort of do that verification piece. I'm totally open to that idea. There is a cash economy in this state. It's in rentals. It's in employment. It's all over the place where we are sort of missing that opportunity to be better about how we collect the revenue that is owed to the state under the current tax laws. And so I'm always interested in ideas about how we shore that up for the existing laws. And if there is sort of this cash rental economy piece that's happening, this could be a mechanism to catch bad offenders.
So line 19 of the bill does require that the landlord receive and retain adequate documentation for eligible rent payments.
Mm-hmm. Great. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you so
Thanks.
Much.
Thank you. I'll be back.
And close the hearing on House Bill 3005. Open a hearing on House Bill 2912. Representative Gomberg. And Cassie, could you please read the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2912 establishes the Affordable Housing Land Acquisition Revolving Loan Fund Program within Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to make loans to eligible organizations to purchase land for development of affordable housing and facilities providing supportive services to low-income households. The bill directs 40% of the loans to be allocated to eligible organizations operating homeownership programs for low-income households and 60% of loans to be allocated to other eligible organizations. The bill specifies loan requirements for development of affordable housing units and repayment for non-compliance. The bill also requires OHCS or the program administrator to collect data and develop performance measures for the program, including financial efficiency. The bill establishes the Affordable Housing Land Acquisition Revolving Fund in the state treasury and continuously appropriates money into the fund to OHCS.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. I'm very pleased to be here today on behalf of House Bill 2912 with my co-sponsors, Representatives Huffman, Johnson, and, of course, your own chair, Kenny Geyer. Representative Huffman was here earlier today. He has a scheduling conflict, and Mr. Manson is going to be sharing some information on behalf of his office. Madam Chair, let me start with a little bit of background, and I know this is all familiar to all of you, but for purposes of our record, I just wanted to provide some context. And you all heard me on the House floor earlier this week talking about how the housing situation we're facing here in Oregon affects Oregonians in very real and personal ways. And I won't reiterate all that now except to say that it is real and very personal. And you also heard me talk about some of the statistics from my own district, that 20% of the kids in my schools are without housing and a predictable place to spend the night, that 60% of my population is challenged by the cost of housing, or that our rental vacancy rate is below 0.5%. And you've also heard me in this committee before talk about how not only does this affect people that are seeking housing and shelter, but it affects the broader community as well when people that work in a community can't find a place to live in that community and how that ripples through the entire economy, whether we're talking about people who are working in hotels or retail establishments or teachers or doctors who can't find a place to live and therefore choose not to come to some of our challenged communities. I share that with you not because you don't know it, but because I wanted to put it into the record of this piece of legislation. So let's talk about 2912. And your staff has given a very appropriate and adequate summary of it, but just let me repeat a couple of details. House Bill 2912 establishes the Affordable Housing Land Acquisition Revolving Loan Fund Program within the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. The purpose of the program is to make loans to eligible organizations purchasing land for development of affordable housing and facilities providing supportive services to low-income households. The program directs 40% of loans be allocated to eligible organizations operating home ownership programs for low-income households, and 60% of loans be allocated to other eligible organizations. The measure specifies loan requirements for development of affordable housing units, including the number of affordable housing units and estimated timeline for completion of development within 5 years of receiving the loan. Repayment for noncompliance is required within 8 years if the loan recipient fails to use the property for the intended affordable housing purposes. OHCS or the program administrator are required to collect data and develop performance measures for the program, including financial efficiency, and present findings to the Legislative Assembly. So that's where we're at, colleagues. I'm very pleased to present this bill, and I think it's part of a much larger and broader conversation that we are having and need to continue having about housing affordability and availability here in Oregon.
Thank you so much. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Joel Mattson, the director of Mid-Columbia Housing Authority and Columbia Cascade Housing Corporation. I work within Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman counties, and we straddle the river and work within Klickitat and Skamania counties in Washington State. I'm excited to be here in support of House Bill 2912, as this very tool is a tool that's available to us across the river, and we've seen its success, and excited to bring this example to the great state of Oregon. The housing crisis does not stop in urban communities. It stretches into rural communities. Every community that we work within is considered a rural community. In Hood River County, we see the needs across the socioeconomic spectrum. 50% for folks that are earning, that are extremely low incomes, we have 3 out of 5 renters with extremely low incomes that are paying more than 50% of their income on rent. In Wasco County, it's 3 out of 4. And in Sherman County, it's 4 out of 5, again, that are paying more than 30% of their income on rent. The housing crisis is affecting all of the communities that we work within. Again, I'm excited to be here in support of House Bill 2912 that makes loans to eligible organizations such as mine to purchase land for affordable housing development. We have 4 main lines of business. One of those is the development of affordable housing. We try to expand our portfolio to help meet the needs. And as much as I like to talk about the good work that our organizations do across the 5-county region, we're falling short, and we need more tools in our toolbox to address that. Oftentimes, we have opportunities that cross our desks for land to acquire and look toward developing for affordable housing, but we can't act quick enough. We can't have all of our financing compiled in an adequate time frame to be able to act quickly on that land. This program would allow us to do that while we work to compile the rest of our financing sources. I also want to mention that this really provides access to capital that some rural communities don't have, and this would greatly help with that. Meanwhile, complementing developer strategies to maintain cost efficiency measures in our development approach, the earlier that we can get more affordable financing mechanisms in place, the more cost-effective the development will be over the long haul. So again, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2912. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ryan. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today in support of this bill on behalf of the Oregon Housing Authorities. In fact, this is a priority for the Oregon Housing Authorities this session. There was a director from Bend who wanted to be here today. He was not able to make the travel, but he wanted to let me know let you know that in Bend there is a local fund that they have that they're able to use in a similar capacity, and it has been an extremely valuable tool for them because, as Joel mentioned, when land comes available, the ability to acquire it and then put together the financing is a very big deal. Also, because this is a revolving loan fund, this will require a one-time seeding of the fund, but it will not be an ongoing expense. And we're even looking at strategies to try to find part of those funds, perhaps all of those funds, from sources outside of general fund. And so that's a strategy that we are looking at. However, we think that a state investment in this makes a lot of sense. It will pay 1% interest, so it will not cost funds even to administer. We think this is a great idea for Oregon, and again, it's a priority item for us. We're in strong support.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. We've got Karen Rockwell, Joel Mattson, and that's Joel. Just Karen Rockwell.
Thank Good morning. I'm Karen Rockwell. I'm the executive director of Benton Habitat for Humanity, located in Corvallis, Oregon. And I really appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of HB 2912. Founded in 1991, Benton Habitat is an affiliate for Habitat for Humanity International. We're a community-based nonprofit organization serving Benton County, Oregon. Our mission is to bring people together to make decent homes achievable for everyone in our community. And working in partnership with low-income families, we've built over 36 homes and have two more underway right now. In addition to our new home construction program, we also offer a critical home repair program, and we average about two critical home repairs a month, providing stable opportunities for people to live in their homes longer. To date, over 195 people in Benton County live in Habitat homes, in Corvallis, Philomath, and Elsie specifically, and this includes 127 children. The need continues to grow dramatically in our area, and the rising costs of lands are becoming a critical barrier to serving more families. HB 2912 is a real and immediate solution to the affordable housing crisis in our area. I echo what the previous panel said with the availability of rentals, which are too high right now. Our rental market is 1% to 2% vacancy rate, and it is primarily driven by a student market. So the for-profit developers right now are focused on maximizing their returns in the rental market for the students. We really don't have an affordable housing stock in Corvallis. If you pull up in MLS right now, you'll see that the homes available are maybe 10 in an affordable housing first-time home buyer market, and those are usually in a serious state of disrepair. A similar program as what is being offered with HB 2912 is being implemented in Washington State, and it's made a significant impact on one of my colleagues' ability to serve more families. The loan program there aided that affiliate to purchase a four-acre piece of land, which today is the site of a healthy community with 32 Habitat homes. With the assistance of a loan program similar to the one proposed in the bill, the Washington Habitat brought up the property values in the area so much so that three for-profit developers also bought area in that land to build more neighborhoods. I strongly encourage you to support this bill and provide a financing tool that can immediately increase the affordable housing stock in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? We also have the Director of Housing and Community Services here in the audience. You don't need to come up unless there, but just to let you know, she is here to testify on another bill. But since this is being run by your department, are there any questions? If not, okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2912, open a public hearing on House Bill 3357, and we're going to start with Ryan Fisher, Jess Larson, and Trell Anderson. Could you please read your comment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3357 increases the fee amount charged and collected by county clerks to $40 for certain real property documents. The bill requires 25% of the money deposited into the general housing account, home ownership assistance, and emergency housing account programs for Oregon Housing and Community Services to be allocated to provide affordable housing and assist veterans. The bill defines affordable housing as housing purchased or rented affordable to individuals of low income or very low incomes.
Chair Genny-Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I promise this is the last time this morning you'll see me. I'm here today to give you a little bit of history about the document recording fee, and I want to start by saying that Representative Greg Matthews sends his regrets. He had hoped to be able to be here to kick this off this morning.
And your name?
Ryan Fisher is my name still. So the document recording fee was first passed by this body in 2009. And what it does is it creates an additional charge on the document recording fees that are being filed from real estate transfers. And those funds go toward affordable housing, and they go into what we call three buckets. So they're allocated toward three different areas of affordable housing, what we sometimes call the continuum of housing. 76% goes toward development of new affordable rental housing. 14% goes toward home ownership programs, and 10% goes toward the emergency housing account, which you've heard me talk about in previous hearings. In 2012, voters passed a constitutional amendment that put a ban on real estate transfer taxes or additional document recording fees. And so in 2013, when this legislature passed a bill that allocated an additional $5, the buckets were not allowed to be changed. In other words, we could not add a new document recording fee. We could expand the existing document recording fee. So that $5 continued to go towards 76% development, 14% home ownership, and 10% emergency housing account. However, what we were able to do is across those buckets allocate a quarter, 25% of all of those different categories to go to serve veterans. And so we went from $15 to $20, and 25% of that will go toward serving veterans. It's been able to do some incredible things. The emergency housing account now has a what we call a veterans EHA down in Klamath Falls. An incredible facility was just built for veterans that have been very hard to serve, Vietnam era veterans. It's just opened up. And this has been one of our only dedicated funding sources and a very important tool. What this bill would do is it would raise that existing $20 fee to $40. But I want to be clear that the buckets will remain the same, and that 25% allocation toward veterans will also remain the same. So the portion, which is currently $5, which is going toward veterans, would become $10 going toward veterans as well. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but there's also other folks here, so I don't want to take any more time.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Sanchez and Olson, members of the committee. My name is Jess Larson. I'm the director of the Welcome Home Coalition, a regional effort in Portland metro region working to address our housing crisis by way of newly dedicated resources so that we can ensure that all families, everyone, has a place to call home. One of the critical purposes of the document recording fee is to fund the Emergency Housing Account, EHA, as we affectionately call it. It's a flexible fund used across the state to prevent homelessness and to help people back into housing once they become homeless. I used these resources all the time when I was on the front lines of the housing crisis, working to help seniors keep their home and prevent ending up in a shelter, working to help seniors get into shelter if they had become homeless, and working to help get seniors back into housing from those shelters. I worked for 8 years at Northwest Pilot Project, a wonderful organization working with seniors in Multnomah County. And when I began my work there, I could welcome a senior into my office and say, "I'm so glad you're here. We're the right agency to help you. It's going to take a while, but I'll work with you step by step to make sure that we get you back into housing and out of this crisis. We'll go all the places you need to go, DMV, Social Security, see your doctor, whatever it's going to take to get you step by step back on track into housing. It's going to take me a little while, though. Let me get you into shelter tonight, and we'll get you on all the right wait lists. And in about 3 months, when your time is up at the shelter, I'll make sure that we have keys to your apartment that you can afford forever on your Social Security check." And we could say that because I was working with seniors, and we wanted an apartment that was affordable forever. And it was good work, and over the time of my tenure there, I became more adept at understanding the tricks of the trade, who to call for what need, what line never to stand in at the DMV, you understand. And over time, the thing I needed most to do my job all but withered away. So now, when seniors go into Northwest Pilot Project, the story sounds a little bit more like this. "I'm so glad you're here. You're right at the right agency. We'll help you step by step all the way through. We'll go to all the right appointments. We'll get you back on track to housing, but it's going to take us a little while. The wait list for shelters are about 6 weeks, and that's if I help you. But if you go in on your own, it's more like 3 months. So work with me. We'll get you into shelter as soon as we can. I don't know where you can go tonight. Do you have a safe place to park your car? Is there someone you can call? I'm sorry. And once we get you into shelter, it might take a few rounds through the shelter because the wait times for housing are really long right now. It's like a year or a year and a half until an affordable apartment will be ready for you. We'll do all that we can. It's going to be a hard, long journey. I'm sorry. I wish there was more I could do. I'm so sorry. This story, this reality is being told in social service agencies across the state right now. There is not more that we can do. The wait lists are impossible to manage. Hope is not possible to offer people when the story, the wait for home, is more than a year and a half. We need to take action. The doc recording fee is a great opportunity to do that. Ongoing dedicated resources for affordable housing are what we absolutely need to get out of this mess, and it's absolutely why we're in this mess to begin with. 40 years of defunding from the federal level and an inability for our local communities to keep up. So we're working hard in the Portland metro region to find flexible funding tools, and we need your help down here in the state to also help match those efforts. In a year of daunting federal cuts to our HUD budget and other critical services, especially healthcare, in a year of daunting reality of $2 billion shortfall here in the state, in a year when the housing crisis is the most daunting task before mayors, commissioners, and state legislators like yourself, I ask, if not now, then when will we take this step? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs, committee members. I'm struck for a second here that there's actually a wait list for shelter, let alone housing. What I have to say really doesn't compare to that.
Can you say your name for the record?
Yeah. My name is Trell Anderson. I grew up in low-income neighborhoods in Kansas City. As a teenager, I hung out in public housing in the afternoons with my friends on the way home from school. Many of these families invited me in for dinner. And looking back now, I so much appreciate and recognize how much they were stretching and struggling to raise their own children, let alone take me in for a meal and a safe place to be. So I wanted to give you that so you know where I'm coming from. Today, luckily, I am the Director of Community Development and Housing at Catholic Charities Oregon and the Executive Director of Caritas Housing, which is the affordable housing development arm of Catholic Charities. I'm here in support of House Bill 3357 to increase the document recording fee and increase affordable housing opportunities across the state. So at Caritas Housing, we have a portfolio of almost 700 units of affordable rental housing. In addition to our current properties in the Portland metro area, we own property in Douglas County. And fortunately, new news is that through a portfolio acquisition of 102 units, we will be preserving properties that are currently subsidized, privately owned, but at risk of converting to market rate in the communities of Rogue River and Glendale. The current document recording fee is used to assist homeless people, to assist new home buyers, to build new veterans housing, and the bulk of the doc fee, again 76%, is used in the financing of multifamily housing development and preservation, like our Rogue River Glendale project. The doc fee is vital to the success of a project. I'm going to be referring to my handout here. Because it fills a funding gap in the project's budget. We call resources like the doc fee gap funding, identified in the handout in the right-hand column in yellow. And gap funding has two benefits in providing affordable housing opportunities. The first benefit is that it complements other funding and helps stretch all the subsidies across more projects and more units across the state. The more funding we have, the more we can build and preserve. It's a straightforward impact statement. Since 2009, the doc fee has generated some $79 million, again with 76% of that dedicated to the general housing account, where Oregon Housing and Community Services has developed a successful and streamlined process where project sponsors like us, we've built and preserved more than 4,000 units in some 55 cities and towns across Oregon. Put simply, it works. There's no question about it. But perhaps not so straightforward, and the second beneficial impact of the dock fee is at a very high level, there's a toggle point in our project budgets, that being the relationship between taking on debt and reducing rents. Here's how it works. Referring to the handout. In market rate housing, when market rate housing is developed, generally speaking, about 20% of the project is owner equity and 80% is debt. It's a bank loan. The higher the rent, the greater the ability to borrow. So the gist of market rate housing development is set rents high so you can borrow more. Push the rents up, borrow more. But in affordable housing, it's the opposite effort. We want to keep rents as low as we can. Low rents equals lesser loan amounts for the banks, thus we have a financial gap. In the Rogue River Glendale project I mentioned previously, again speaking generally for illustration purposes, only 35% of the project budget is a loan from the bank. So where's the rest come from? Well, the remainder is a layering of different subsidies that come from federal, state, local, private sources, including funding generated from the current dock fee, thank you, previously. In the Rogue River project, we have 9 different fund sources layered in with a bank loan. In affordable housing, the gist is to borrow as little as possible because that allows us to keep rent down. The greatest effort in the layering challenge, our greatest efforts are in layering these different resources, because the more layering of resources like the low-income housing tax credit, federal home phones, the state's general housing account funded with the dock fee, the lower the rents can be. The toggle point in a project budget is the more dock fee in that layering, the lower we can set the rents. So I've been working in this field in Oregon for 22 years, and I believe that the dock fee is one of the most successful, most streamlined, most purposely allocated, and one of the most important revenue sources we have for affordable housing. There's a direct correlation here. With an increase in the document recording fee, we're increasing our ability to drive rents down, provide stable housing. With an increase in stable housing, we're increasing our ability for people to transition from homelessness, the ability for seniors and people with disabilities to live without fear of losing their housing, the ability of our veterans to live in peace, and the ability of our families to support their children to go to school and to thrive. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? We have several more coming up. Okay, thank you. Next, can we have Rob Ovett and James Morales?
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovett, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. First, I should say, on behalf of my client, pretty much ditto to everything you heard. Counties are very concerned about the affordable housing crisis throughout Oregon and want to find creative ways to solve pieces of it. It's at epidemic proportions now, as you all know, so I won't repeat any of that. However, my client is strongly opposed to this bill as currently written, which you might find odd. So let me explain. In 2009, when this fee was put into place, a very strange provision in the bill included something that exempted this particular fee from the normal 5% administrative fee charged on all recording fees that helps support, at least in part, the vital public recording fee or recording system that is vital to our entire real estate property transaction world. That created, in my legal opinion, not just an unfunded mandate on counties to impose and collect this fee, but an unconstitutional unfunded mandate. That frustrated my client because this is vital revenue and resources that we use to fund the recording system itself. So in my opinion, since 2009, this fee has constituted an unconstitutional unfunded mandate. So we are asking you to repeal that particular paragraph as part of this bill and amend that bill to do so and end this unconstitutional unfunded mandate. As you may know, the state gets about roughly 10% of this revenue source for its own administrative fees, and we get nothing. That doesn't make sense because the real property transaction recording system helps protect everybody and is vital to the entire real property system in Oregon. So we ask that you pass this bill at whatever fee increase level you choose, from $0 to $20, whatever it happens to be, but you repeal that offending paragraph that upsets my client and, in my opinion, is unconstitutional. With that said, we would agree with the rough numbers that you've heard. We did a survey of county clerks, and last year we recorded about 733,000 documents that were subjected to this fee. That translates to between $14 and $15 million a year, which is essentially what is in your measure summary from your staff. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I'd turn it over to Mr. Morales from the Clerks Association.
Thank you. James Morales, Benton County Clerk, here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. When this fee was first adopted in 2009 with the $15 fee, it did not include the 5%, which you've already heard, for the County Clerk's dedicated fund. The importance of dedicated fund, you've heard from the Housing and Community Services Department. As you know, our general funds are increasingly being placed demands upon, and this particular dedicated fund is very important to the county clerk's ability to preserve the records, secure the records. You know, we have a highly digital system now where we do electronic recordings in almost every county in the state of Oregon. We have demands being placed upon our offices to increase that to every county. We try and use these funds in a manner that was intended to be used by the legislature when it was passed, and that was to acquire systems for storage and retrieval of our records, pay for the costs of collecting the fee, as well as being able to purchase maintenance contracts for the record system and the equipment that supports the process. Now, property ownership is, you know, vital to the American dream. When we have a system that is secure, well maintained, we're able to help people acquire housing, which is part of what the affordable housing fee is looking to do. We also provide banks with the assurance that when they give people a loan, that the people that they're actually giving the loan to actually own the property. So taking this fee from $15 to $20, we still didn't get the 5% that we need to support these systems. Now that we're going from 20 to 40, we're asking the legislature to please provide us with the dedicated funds we need to support all of the programs, not just assessment and taxation, which helps us collect the fees that that support our ability to get the service districts the funding, and as well as the cities and the county to collect the taxes and do the assessments needed to do so in tax collection. Okay. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I'm not speaking too well today, but that's what I'm hoping.
Thank you. Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question to both of you, and I'm not sure if you have the answer, but my question to you is this. Are you able to provide your services currently under all the funding capacity that you have to your to the folks out there in our public right now? That's the first of two questions.
Chair Ginnegar and Representative Meek, that's a little difficult to answer in the abstract, but if we refine your question to say if we're able to provide the recording services, I think that's what you're focused in, the real property recording system, we're having to drain off precious general fund resources to support that system right now. Those are the same resources that we, you know, essentially used to have sheriff's deputies on patrol and various other services that are vital public services that counties provide. So the drain on general fund resources at a county level can really pinch, especially in many of our counties that are in fiscal distress. So what we're facing now is the need, the desperate need, to modernize our recording system, to make it all scanned, available to the public, online, ease of access, and preserved in a manner that preserves it forever. So we're facing and looking at very significant expenses in maintaining and modernizing our current real property recording system and exempting this fee or any fee from the normal 5% that goes into the special fee that we have to support that system is, and not only in my opinion, an unconstitutional unfunded mandate, but it's just the wrong policy choice.
And then my follow-up question is that you wanted to, we have an emergency crisis right now. You're providing a job, and I know a lot of counties already have the technology that are doing exactly what you just said, and they're electronically recording, everything is being filed and there for prosperity. Do we want to take this moment, this time in history right now, to take funds away from housing and families that need housing and funds? Is that's what I'm asking. And I guess publicly I'm asking, are you going to fight this so that we can't get funds to housing? And that's my only question.
And Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Meek, my client actually supports this bill if it's allowed to take its administrative fee to support the system based upon it. But your question is, would we fight? If you're talking about increasing it from essentially $15 million to $30 million of resources, that's what this bill really poses. The state is taking 10% for its administrative purposes so it can run the system. We're asking for 5% so we can run the system.
Representative Meek, may I answer? Chair Geyer?
Yep.
Kenny Geyer. The amount of funds that we get from the 5% is very small compared to the amount that it actually takes to support the system. In Benton County, we're lucky to get $30,000 a year from the 5%. The cost just for my software maintenance alone is $20,000. And that doesn't speak to the cost for preserving a lot of the older records, getting the microfilm services, because we're required to get microfilm for permanent records. There are so many things that we would like to do with these funds, like going back to some of the old documents and indexes that get damaged from public use in our vaults. We have two copies. We're required to keep a public access copy of our records as well as the permanent records that we keep both in our office, and we send up another copy up to the state archives, which also assesses a fee that we pay to the state archives for storing the microfilm records there. Now, so what we get from the fee just helps do a minimum amount in a county like mine to offset the costs of what we're actually doing and the increased demand on general fund dollars by all the things we want to do. I mean, what we're doing, we're doing good things. I mean, the one of the fees we collect is for the public land corner preservation for the surveyor. Those funds go through, we get 5% of that. And counties set that at different levels. We've got the OLIS fund, which does the ORMAPS project that we fund through the recording fee. Like I mentioned earlier, the A&T fee, in addition to the A&T affordable housing fee, do vital things. And we're all for supporting those programs. That's not what this is about. This is for supporting our program, which the legislature that adopted this 5% fee way back understood that and what our testimony was back then is that we are having problems getting the money we need to keep this record system up so that we can have the business community, the banking industry, the realty industry, the home ownership.
Okay, we're going to squeeze in one more very quick question and then we've got to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really briefly, if we were to raise the fee to 42, would that help with the situation you're talking about? If you took the $2 and put that into your system, would that be enough to cover the costs that you have?
Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Gorsuch,
it still would only cover a small piece of it, but however you want to structure it, it is fine by us. We just believe that all of the fees that are imposed upon right. recording should have 5% or its equivalent
right.
be its proportionate share of paying the expense of the entire system that supports right. all of this activity.
So that could help, though.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. So next we have John Chandler and Sean Jillians.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Original panel, we couldn't agree more with. I thought that was very compelling testimony as far as the needs that are out there, and I was delighted to hear that a bill that we sponsored in 2009 has been one of the most successful programs for dedicated funding. I think we do have concerns about doubling that fee, and part of the reason for that, Madam Chair, and it's an ongoing dialogue that we've had this session, is effectively we've all acknowledged that there's a crisis. We've all acknowledged that there are significant issues that we need to address, and the question then becomes, who's responsible for funding all of it? Is that entirely on the back of homeowners and people who refinance, or is this a societal problem that perhaps would warrant, for the first time in probably our state's history, some general fund dollars to it? I would say that we're in a time of crisis, and the general fund would be a very likely source of revenue for some of these programs. I acknowledge that we're looking at a deficit for current service levels, but at the same time, we also have record revenue for our state, and we're approaching a $70 billion all-funds budget. If this truly is one of the more important issues facing us, which we agree that it is, then I think that's where we should start looking. As you heard the statistics from the first panel, only 14% of the fee currently goes to home ownership. When we originally put the fee in place, we recognized the housing continuum and the need for affordable rentals and keeping people from being homeless. I think it's been very successful at that. Again, though, I go back to the question of, is that entirely the duty of homeowners and those refinancing to fund those programs? While I agree completely with the first panel, I thought that was very compelling testimony. I couldn't disagree more with your second panel. There are a few different issues in there. First and foremost, I've received a lot of phone calls from county commissioners of why are the realtors not supporting a 5% cut for the counties. And they tend to focus only on ORS 205-323, which is where our fee is. I would implore you all to look at ORS 205-320, which is another series of fees that the county clerks may collect on the recording of these documents. In particular, 1DA, they get $5 per page for recording these documents. To say that there's no administrative fee for this, they get $5 per page for recording these documents under the current statute. Do they get an additional 5% on this particular fee? No, they do not. That was very purposeful when we put the bill in place, because we recognized they were already getting $5 per page for recording these documents. We were putting a new fee in place, and we were saying that for this new fee, all of it's got to go to the housing programs. Mr. Fisher made one other point on that. There was reference to public access. If you look further in 205-320, they are allowed to charge $3.75 for each document that they make available to the public, including 25 cents per page. So in order to provide public access, they get the $5 to record it, then they get an additional $3.75 plus 25 cents under the statute per page. So we feel like the system itself already has significant revenue for the county clerks. We've been very focused on just the document recording fee on housing, this particular increase. Last, Mr. Fisher made reference to Measure 79. That's actually Article 9, Section 15 of the Constitution, written by a brilliant attorney, I assure you. That was me, if you didn't pick up on that. when we put that constitutional prohibition in place, we were very definitive in that we would allow the current document recording fee to stay in place. That's why you have a certain effective date for fees. When the $5 for veterans was introduced in 2013, Legislative Council actually came back with a legal opinion saying it was unconstitutional and it violated Article 9, Section 15. I, working with the proponents, went to Legislative Council and said, I'm the one who actually drafted it. This is my intent. You can increase an existing fee, but you have to do exactly that existing fee. If there's any change in the breakout, and trust me, we'd love to see more go to home ownership than 14%, but we've stayed with that. If there's any change in that, that's a new fee. And that is our legal opinion as the person who drafted the constitutional provision that violates Article 9, Section 15. So not only are we in philosophy opposed to it, legally we would oppose any sort of change in the breakout. With that, Madam Chair, happy to let Mr. Chandler go. Happy to answer any particular questions you all might have.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to the fee increase. And not because I, like Mr. Jillian, so was not moved by the testimony you've heard, or because we're unaware of the housing crisis facing the state. It's primarily because, and I'm going to use a quote from Mr. Tim Nesbitt, who did it in a different context. So I'm not trying to associate the quote with this issue, but merely give attribution for a good line. He wrote in the paper some time ago that some issues are so important that somebody else should pay for them. I am here frustrated again on a different topic, but the frustration is this is legitimate. The only new money in the last 20, 30 years in for housing in the state of Oregon has come from the real estate industry, either from the document recording fee. Mr. Jillians has walked through the history there. The 1999 or the 2009 changes came after an extensive work group between lenders and builders and realtors and bankers and mortgage people and the housing advocates and the agencies. That was a good effort, and we understood each other's issues much more, and as a result of that came up with the document recording fee that used, again, the real estate transaction process. Then very recently, we, in 2016, authorized local governments to adopt a real construction excise tax with the proceeds dedicated. Very similar. There is no general fund money going to this issue. Like Mr. Jillian's indicated, if it's important, which it is, let's pay for it. But let's not figure out ways that somebody else should pay for these very important things. That's our frustration, Madam Chair and members. Not that we don't think the issue is important, not that we don't think that somebody that it needs to be attended to, and not that we don't think it's been underfunded historically, but let's please quit trying to figure out ways that don't put the state's money where its collective mouth is on an issue of this merit. We agree with the need. We agree with the way the money's being spent. We supported those breakouts. We think the agencies are doing an excellent job with it. We commend the department for doing a lot of good work with limited resources. But that's not the point. The point is to add another burden to the industry, whether, and it's not going to break the bank. I won't try here to try to kid you that it will. It's the principle, which I think is worth defending, that we've done our part. We would like to ask you all collectively, this body, to do its part.
So, and just for the record, for the purpose of this committee, some of the EHA funds, Emergency Housing Assistance Funds, have come out of the general budget because we know that what comes out of the document recording fee, the 10% that goes to EHA, has not been enough in our huge crisis. So that was, unfortunately, we have to keep renewing it. It's not a dedicated source. It's one-time funding. We have pulled preservation bonds out of the lottery back bonds, and we have done the LIFT program, which I know you're very supportive of, and I'm counting on you to be supportive of an expansion, $40 million out of LIFT for general obligation bonds. I couldn't agree more that we need to pull more out of the general fund, but we all know the deficit that we're facing. This committee is going to be looking at working a lot of bills that have been put on the table with the land acquisition, home ownership revolving fund, a whole bunch of bills that are going to be moving forward mm-hmm. that are going to need support, probably out of the general fund, because we only have two dedicated sources of funding, the affordable housing tax credit that we're looking at renewing and perhaps expanding, and this, the document recording fee, because as you know, the real estate transfer tax, which is something that many states use, many cities use, Seattle uses for its big grand bargain, was banned in the Constitution from being able to use that. So we have very few sources that we can look to, in addition to general funds, which are very strapped this particular year. I've been a big supporter of trying to expand that. We'll continue to work on that. But didn't need it to say for the record that we have, in my 5.5 years here, we have been pulling money out of general fund because these dedicated sources are not going far enough.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think our point was direct general fund dollars, not necessarily obligation bonds and construction for that. And the thing I would just add, and Mr. Chandler touched on it, we do have another dedicated source, and that's the construction excise tax that we agreed to, and Portland has actually implemented it. And 50% of that does come back to the state. So there are two strong revenue streams. We haven't recognized the full value of the construction excise tax because not all local governments have implemented it, but as they start doing that, that will be a significant source of revenue for OHCS.
That's true. I know it's one of the lowest in the West Coast out of all the cities, but I'm glad that we made some progress on that. 1%.
San Jose Chair, has $7. Like we're bargaining against ourselves already.
Okay. couldn't help but let that go, and it's of course only if cities choose to adopt it. In any case, you know, as some of you may know, I am a chief sponsor of this bill. I am passionate about, if we're going to talk about supply, mm-hmm. we need to have revenue sources for this. So my question, I know that Rob Bovet remarked on this, that he is for it if amended and not for it if not amended. You are clearly not for it if 5% goes to the county clerks. Where are you on this bill if we do not give 5% to the county clerks?
I think we still have significant concerns, Madam Chair, with doubling the fee on homeowners and people who refinance.
All right.
And Madam Chair, if I might, I stand corrected on no money from general fund. I will amend it, if you don't mind, to limited money from general fund. And my point remains, the doubling of a fee, the doubling isn't the issue. It's the fact that this body again, and you and I have had this conversation, I suspect we'll have it again, not just on housing issues, has been pretty diligent at finding other people to pay for things. I'm here telling you, we from the industry are really sort of would like to have a different conversation about how that might occur. And I'm happy to, and I think Mr. Jones and I both would engage with you on other ways to get money into these critical needs. Doubling the recording fee probably would not be our preferred choice.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. So last we have Karen Sachs and Allison McIntosh.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, and Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. My name is Karen Sachs, and I work at NEDCO, a nonprofit housing counseling agency serving Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties. I'm here to talk about the impact of the 14% of the document recording fee that goes to homeownership programs. NEDCO provides financial and pre-purchase education and counseling throughout our three offices to low and moderate income first-time homebuyers. Our classes help clients understand the home buying process, connect with local lenders and real estate agents, plan for those unexpected homeownership expenses, and avoid predatory lending practices. We build upon this knowledge in one-on-one counseling sessions that ensure our clients are ready to take the step to homeownership, that their financial and credit picture make them mortgage ready, and that they've assembled a team of professionals that they can trust. But NEDCO is not alone in this work. We are part of a network of 17 homeownership centers that support all 36 counties throughout Oregon. Homeownership centers are neutral third-party supports for first-time homebuyers in analyzing and repairing their credit, creating both a before and after home purchase budget, and evaluating the mortgage product that's right for them. One family we recently worked with was the Marshalls, a young couple looking to purchase their first home. They came to NEDCO for more information on the home buying process as well as to get connected to a homeownership counselor. As they began their search, they quickly realized that the personal savings that they had pulled together for a down payment was just not nearly enough to meet the increasing home prices in Lane County. With no additional financial support available from their family, they were at a loss for options. Through our down payment assistance award from OHCS, we were able to add to their personal savings to have a successful down payment, and they just recently purchased and closed their home. The document recording fee is the only source of funding for homeownership centers and down payment assistance. This dedicated funding stream ensures that first-time homebuyers across Oregon can access support throughout the process. Down payment assistance offers a chance at homeownership in a market that is pricing out low and moderate income families. In 2016, we served over 650 families in our financial and homebuyer education and counseling programs. With our most recent down payment assistance award, we're serving 12 families, but the need and demand for those services far exceeds current funding levels. NEDCO already has close to 40 first-time homebuyers looking to purchase this year, but many will face a housing market with skyrocketing housing prices, leaving little to no available affordable homeownership options. The document recording fee provides invaluable support for homeownership centers throughout Oregon. I'd urge you to support HB 3357 and the expansion of the document recording fee to ensure that ongoing assistance can be provided to Oregonians looking to build financial stability and assets through homeownership. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance to ask for your support for House Bill 3357. I think there's been a lot that's been covered. You've heard from a lot of experts who've used these funds firsthand over the last 8 years that the document recording fee has been in existence. You've also heard some incredible stories this morning about the need for housing all over our state, both in earlier bills as well as this one. So I won't belabor the point. I think what I would like to share with you this morning is the story of this successful program that we've had since 2009. As you heard from representatives from the home builders and the realtors, in 2009, the Housing Alliance came together with industry partners to pass this recording fee and to create ongoing dedicated revenue sources and to provide housing opportunity for thousands and thousands of Oregonians across the state since that time. The document recording fee has raised about $79 million since it was passed in 2009, and it's done incredible things. It's helped build 4,000 apartment homes in 55 cities and towns across Oregon. It's provided thousands of families with emergency rent assistance and families with counseling to buy their first home and down payment assistance. It's been an extremely successful tool, and I think, as several of you know from hearing the Housing and Community Services budget this week, we're facing both an unprecedented crisis as well as a time of potential federal budget cuts. On Wednesday last week, Housing and Community Services Department reported that the president's budget initially cuts about $115 million from their budget. We also have a number of general fund asks in front of both this committee, as well as we've made several of that, are asking for expansions of pretty much any funding source that we think could be successful in helping us to stem this crisis. So we're here today to ask for your help in solving this crisis, and we think the document recording fee has been an extremely successful tool, and we would love to see it increase to $40 to help solve this crisis. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just really one quick question.
We'll just do one question and then move on.
So Allison, you mentioned a number of how many homes have been built since?
Vice Chair Olson, it's helped build about 4,000 units. So if you remember Terrell's chart, it goes in as kind of a slice to help build projects all over the state. It helps fill those gaps, and the number is about 4,000 units.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry to rush this. We've got to keep moving on here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3357, open a public hearing on House Bill 2315, technical fix on tax credit for affordable housing. Our only other dedicated source.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Olson and Sanchez. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. We're here to talk to you this morning about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. As you know, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit has been a vital tool to help produce affordable housing throughout the state. And to date, it has helped to finance more than 337 affordable properties and creating homes for more than 11,000 households and families across the state. In addition to allocating the OAHTC, our agency is also responsible for the back end or the compliance component of the program, which means that we oversee the properties that receive the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit to ensure that property owners are complying with the program. Today we are here to discuss our agency bill, HB 2315, which proposes a technical fix to the program to allow our agency to better oversee these properties. With me today are two members of our team, Ariel Nelson and Teresa Pumala, who will provide more detail on our proposed fix and be able to answer your questions. So I'd like to ask Ariel Nelson to start us off.
We have one more bill after this and then work a few bills. So if, I know it's very technical. Keep it as tight as you can. And if people have questions, they can follow up with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Sanchez, and Vice Chair Olson. For the record, my name is Ariel Nelson. I'm the Government Relations and Communications Liaison for Oregon Housing and Community Services. So as Margaret said, House Bill 2315 is a technical fix. It's a piece of statutory cleanup that the agency has had on the shelf since 2015 when we passed an administrative rule that got really specific about how we want those properties that use the OAHTC to calculate their compliance. And when we talk about that, I'll just give you a little bit of background so we can kind of get into some brief detail on what that means. As you know, the OAHTC is a state tax credit to lenders to reduce the interest rate on loans for the development or rehabilitation of affordable housing. Affordable housing developers receive a reduced mortgage interest rate, and in return, they're required to pass through that savings to their tenants in the form of reduced rent. Affordable housing projects benefiting from the OHTC have to demonstrate a dollar-for-dollar pass-through, and that's what we're talking about in this rule. They have to show that pass-through to their tenants, and they can calculate that in a variety of ways. No matter how they do it, whether they spread it over the entire property over all units or they want to draw it down on just a few units to make those units extra affordable, each property is assigned an annual average pass-through based on the full mortgage interest discount that's realized over the life of the loan, then divided by the amount of years in the loan and by the total units in the property. So each year the property has to meet that annual average pass-through. In 2015, the agency passed a rule because we learned that some property managers were incorrectly using the value of tenant-based HUD rental vouchers to demonstrate the pass-through to meet their compliance under the OAHTC. So we fixed that in 2015 through administrative rule, and House Bill 2315 is really just the next step in cleaning that up and clarifying how we want those properties to calculate that pass-through and demonstrate compliance when they have tenants with tenant-based vouchers in their properties. And so Teresa Pluma is our tax credit manager, and we have a couple examples, very simplified examples on the screen to kind of make, to give you a way to look at what we're talking about.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Teresa Pumula. I'm Tax Credit Program Manager for Oregon Housing and Community Services. So our examples that we have up on the screen, again, are very simplified examples, but give you two different ways that the OAHTC pass-through could be calculated in a 10-unit property. So in example one, what you'll see is the pass-through on a monthly basis would, for this small property, needs to equal approximately, equal $500 per month. The way that this particular property in example one has chosen to do it is to deep skew five of the units so that they could significantly reduce the rent for those particular units. In example two, what they have done is just give the average per unit right across the board for all 10 units. The way that this then works is that, let's say in example two, where we have everybody here has a lease, so we have a contract on what they're going to pay every month. But then unit two, or it could be unit two, unit 10, doesn't matter, one of the units has their lease end, and that tenant decides to move out. So the next qualified tenant that then moves in has a tenant-based voucher, a housing choice voucher. So then what do you do if you're a property manager? You're looking at this and saying, okay, where do I put my additional pass-through? I have all of these other people under contract. So
This would put them into automatic noncompliance. That is one of the reasons that we want to give flexibility to work with them to make sure that, we would not have to find them in noncompliance through no fault of their own. We would then work with them to look through how they could give us the pass-through in different ways. We just do not want to force into a situation where the few properties where this comes up, we don't want them forced into a noncompliant situation.
And so House Bill 2315 just clarifies and codifies that change in rule that we made. And it's also going to give us some more flexibility as we continue to examine our partners, the property owners and managers, as we, you know, look and see how they're dealing with this market. And we can help them get more specific, stay in compliance, but also make sure that we are being efficient with this important state resource and, you know, maximizing the pass-through discount to tenants as much as possible.
Okay, any questions for this panel? Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2315 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2433. Representative Parrish, I think, is right outside the door, so if she hears, no, why don't you, well, if you could go grab it, could you please read the summary of the bill?
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2433 directs Housing and Community Services Department to establish housing co-location pilot program with school districts building low-income senior housing on school district property. The bill limits rent to a certain percentage of the senior's income and requires classroom assistance from the senior. The bill establishes the low-income senior housing co-location fund and directs continuous appropriation of the money to OHCS for construction costs of the housing pilot program. The bill authorizes the state treasurer to issue lottery bonds to the low-income senior housing co-location fund for bond-related costs. The pilot program sunsets January 2nd, 2021, and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. Once again, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, bringing you House Bill 2433. And one of the things that you are getting from committee services is an article that was actually published about 15 years ago. And in another world, when I came and worked for a school district, I was brought in on a bond project to actually do some of the, as part of the nutrition service program, to actually help work with building out kitchens.
Okay.
And so that you get a lot of magazines and different, school construction articles that come to you when you're in that process. And one of the things that had caught my eye, and it wasn't specifically this article, but in going back and trying to look for it, came across this article, Catching the Age Wave, Building Schools with Senior Citizens in Mind. And while this bill's article doesn't specifically talk about senior housing, it does talk about sort of the crisis that we find ourselves in right now around public schools as it relates to infrastructure capacity. And so you've got a wave of baby boomers who are retiring and who are worrying about their own sort of housing and the ability to sort of just keep existing as they see their cost of living increasing while their maybe cost of retirements or the value of those retirements aren't appreciating. And then this article, foreshadowing, talking about where we saw dips in our school population, which we all did, and then with millennial kids who are now having children who are kindergartners and beyond, seeing an explosion in school district population. And so 15 years ago, this article was talking about how we need to start building our schools and thinking about our school district properties with seniors in mind, because it's the seniors who are going to vote on property taxes. And right now we see that we're struggling to pass bonds for school districts across the state. Portland Public has a very hefty bond that they're going out for. I think it's doubtful that it's going to pass. And that doesn't mean that you don't have schools that need to be worked on, that schools that don't have lead in the pipes, schools that have crumbling infrastructure just as we have crumbling infrastructure all over the place. And so this bill is really designed in mind to solve two issues. When we come to this building, everybody who comes to testify or come to our offices, the conversation we consistently have is, we're going to cut seniors or we're going to cut schools. And this is a bill that says that we don't have to do either of those. If we start to blend the lines of how we think about our school district dollars, think about our housing dollars, So House Bill 2433 would cite a pilot project. I'm agnostic of whose district gets a pilot, but you could do the backside piece of property at Vestal Elementary, which is where I went in fourth grade, and recently there was an article over the weekend talking about just how much families are struggling in that school. It broke my heart as a former student to think about how much that particular school has degraded over the years. It could be a school property out in rural Oregon. I'm, like I said, agnostic of where this bill get cited, however, the project gets cited. But when you think about who has land and who are landowners, school districts are large landowners in our state. Most of them could cite, a lot of them could cite a facility like this. So what we're talking about is a 20 to 30 unit type housing project co-located at a school district. And the social compact infrastructure of this is that in exchange for that low income rent, we need you to put some time in our schools. And there is not a model for this anywhere, but there are models like this in other sort of blended capacities. I read an article recently about a senior low income senior housing project being built on top of a library in Chicago. Read about a person who was citing helping to fund some charter schools in another state where they built teacher housing and they co-located housing for the teachers right with the schools. So this is happening other places. This is an opportunity to think about a generation of folks who has a lot to offer but is struggling to get by. So this bill would take a few million dollars, bond it, help build a school facility, and ideally we would work with a nonprofit housing partner to be the landlord, but there would be a rent share with the school district under this bill. So if you imagined a $500 unit, 20 units in a at a site, that's about a $60,000 rent share to the school district. They could use that to bond the next building with, because you've got a rent stream that goes with it, and theoretically they could build out all of their schools. The value to this, when you talk then about what does the school district get back in the classroom? We have 197 school districts in the state. Probably not all school districts will do this, but if we averaged even just one per school district, we're talking about 30 seniors per district who are volunteering in their community. That's 5,900 seniors. That is 59,000 labor hours per week. That is the equivalent of 1,477 full-time FTE back in our school district. It is at $60,000 FTE fully loaded. That's about $90 million back in our general fund that we aren't having to pay out to help educate kids. And let's talk about who those kids are. We know that a lot of these kids are kids who are not reading. I was horrified to see a slide in our education subcommittee the other day that showed that we're excited that only 48% of our kids can read by third grade, and that kids of color are only reading at 29%, but we'd only set a bar for them at 21%. So when we talk about extra hands in the classroom, people who are committed volunteers, people who can bring that experience. To me, this is a really interesting opportunity to use an existing tax resource of school district land that we've already bought and paid for, co-locate it with housing, and then ask for that social compact with seniors who get a deal on the rent. We are struggling right now to figure out where we site housing, and we can have lots of conversations about whether landlord-tenant laws or things are going to solve the problems that we're feeling right now with our rental crisis. But we need 80,000 units in the metro area. So we've got to deal with the supply side piece of that. The other piece is that making sure that folks can age in place with dignity and finding a place that's long-term and stable for them is really appealing to me. And I don't know. Oh, Soren Mentz was going to testify today from OSCA. I don't see her in the room. But it was interesting. She came up to me after a committee the other day when she thought this bill was on the docket to be heard, and said, you know what, this is our OSCA classified staff. These are the staff who are our IAs, lunch ladies, part-time janitors. They would love an opportunity. They're already volunteering extra time. They'd love an opportunity to put additional time in and be co-located right there. So it was very interesting to hear her say that, you know, she would, that OSCA would support something like this. So, you know, I think it's important that this is separate and distinct from any other housing bonding dollars that we do this session for other projects that are that the agency's really interested in. I think we need to take this on as a project, because if we do it and do it right, it's a way to both serve seniors and educate kids, and to make sure that we are using our resources wisely in a time when we are struggling to figure out how to use resources. So I would urge that this committee support this bill. If we do decide to work this, it does need a quick amendment because there is a piece of language that needs to be flipped. The goal is not that the school is the landlord. The goal is that the nonprofit's the landlord, so that language needs to just be turned around. It was a drafting error, but I'll take any questions and hope we...
So, Representative Parrish, it's a very interesting idea. The one question that I have for you is, you know, we worry a lot about background checks for people who...
And this bill does address that.
Does that address... Okay.
Yeah, we don't want, you know, folks who are sex offenders or can't pass a background check. Exactly. We don't do that in our normal school district employees either.
Right.
So I think we would use that same... Representative Parrish, I think we would use that same standard that we currently use to have people in our school districts, you know, back fingerprints and go through LEDs and make sure that they can safely be co-located on a facility.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. And we've got one person to testify, Jim Davis. Please be very brief. I'm sorry I had to do this to you last week, too, but we've got four bills to work as well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens and the United Seniors of Oregon, state affiliates of the National Council on Aging. I'm here in support of House Bill 2433, which would develop this housing project within the school districts in exchange for elder support in the classroom. I'm not sure how seriously this concept is being considered, but I can tell you I think this is a wonderful intergenerational pilot project and concept and should be very, very seriously considered. As a gerontologist, educator, and longtime Gray Panther, I have been involved for many decades in projects and efforts to send elders into the classroom. And I also produced a nationally telecast documentary, Bridging the Generations, where we looked at school-based projects, and I was able to see firsthand very successful intergenerational efforts in both secondary and elementary and secondary levels of education. Elders can do all kinds of stuff. They can be tutors. They can be classroom assistants. They can be mentors and support students. It's a very special relationship between elders and younger people. And younger people learn about aging. They learn about human development. I've been involved in the development of curriculum, and this would be a wonderful area to go into is actually integrating seniors into curriculum and teaching. We've seen successful panels of seniors, particularly in history or other classes, human development classes, where you have a panel of seniors that can come in and talk about their involvement in certain aspects of history or their involvement in human development. I think it's very critical that young people have this training in human development. A couple final points. It really is important for us to strongly support efforts being made to integrate intergenerational programming into the school system. We've seen successful examples with RSVP and foster grandparents and other programs of that nature. Seniors can have a great impact on young lives and can help them significantly in their learning environments.
Thank you. Soren, I saw you just walked in. If you could just keep it really brief, because we've got four bills to work before 10 o'clock.
Yes, absolutely. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Soren Metzger on behalf of the Oregon School Employees Association. And I was particularly very excited when I saw this bill, House Bill 2433, because the majority of our membership are over the age of 55 years old. And when I looked at the specifics of the bill, the federal poverty level of 150%, a lot of our folks who are actually working would qualify for this benefit. And so we're really very excited. I thank you so much for taking the opportunity to hear from me. I want to say my coworker will be submitting written testimony, so I just wanted to put our support on the record for House Bill 2433. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2433, and we're opening a work session on House Bill 3261. would you like to read a quick summary of what this is?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3261 requires Oregon Health Authority to collaborate with the Office of Rural Health to develop a uniform application form for all health care provider financial incentive programs and maintain a website with information on financial incentive programs. The bill modifies eligibility requirements for the Rural Medical Care Tax Credit and Health Care Provider Incentive Program for rural and medically underserved areas.
That's enough.
It's effective. Okay.
So the basic thing is that we want to move this to the Health Committee. This was, I think, mistakenly sent to our committee, and so we want to just re-refer it to the Health Committee. So that is what we're doing.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3261 without recommendation to the House Committee on Health Care.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3261 without recommendation to the House Committee on Health Care. Is there any discussion?
Nope.
Is there any objection?
No.
Seeing none, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Forsyth?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative
Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Guyer? Aye. Okay, House Bill 3261 is referred to the House Committee on Health Care. Rep. Olson, second motion. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you read briefly? Thank you. Close the work session on, that was House Bill, the previous one, 3261. Open a work session on House Bill 3275. Cassie, could you give us a really brief one sentence?
House summary. Bill 3275 requires applicant for housing development containing at least 100 new housing requirements to give written notice to Department of Education and school district.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3275 without recommendation to the House Committee on Education.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 3275 without recommendation to the House Committee on Education. Is there any discussion? Let me just also say this is not about developing affordable housing. It says when there's a big affordable housing unit that, and all of a sudden the school is going to be inundated with 100 new students or so, they just need to give notice so that the school district can plan. So really this should have gone to education. So any further discussion? Any objection? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative
Lorsick? Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative
Grusa?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Guyer?
Aye. Okay. House Bill 3275 is passed on to the House Committee on Education. I'm going to close the work session. House Bill 3275, open a work session on House Bill 2316. Could you give us a brief reminder of
House Bill 2316 requires city outside a metropolitan area with population less than 25,000 to determine estimate housing needs, inventory supply of buildable lands, and adopt measures to accommodate estimated housing need for periodic or legislative review of the comprehensive plan, applying the statewide planning goal related to buildable lands for residential use. We have both the fiscal and the revenue. The fiscal is indeterminate, and there is no revenue impact.
And when did we hear this bill?
We heard it on the 14th of March.
Okay. All right.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2316 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair also moves House Bill 2316 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just very briefly.
Yes.
I'll say that the reading this bill is kind of frustrating because it's kind of like you have to get a bale of hay and a bunch of carrots, but you're not getting a pony because we don't ever expand urban growth boundaries. So what's the point? So I'll just put that on the record.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objection?
You can't have a pony.
If not, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Representative, or Vice Chair
Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kenny Guyer?
Aye. House Bill 2316 passes, moves to the floor. Would anyone like to carry this measure?
Oh, I will.
Okay, great. Thank you, Representative Gorsuch. And we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2316. And finally, open a work session on House Bill 2347.
House Bill 2347 extends for 2 years until 2019, authorizing Department of Human Services to offer resources to individuals eligible for temporary assistance for needy families, or TANF, including the Job Opportunity and Basic Skills Program. The bill suspends for 2 years till 2019, allowing the increase in cash assistance paid to families enrolled in the state's family pre-supplemental security income or Social Security Disability Insurance Program. The bill also suspends for 2 years till 2019, allowing the increase for the period that a family receiving TANF may continue to receive assistance upon becoming ineligible due to employment or increased hours of work. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We last heard this bill on March 7th. We have both the revenue and the fiscal. There's no revenue impact, and the fiscal allows $22 million from the general fund in cost avoidance.
Meaning savings. It's a savings of $22 million.
If the bill doesn't pass, then there would be a request for $22 million from the general fund.
It's a saving because we're suspending the program. Okay. All right.
So, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2347 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair also moves House Bill 2347 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative
Heath? Aye.
Representative
Nierman? Aye.
Representative
Noble? Aye.
Representative
Paluso? Aye.
Representative
Stark? Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Gennigan?
Aye. House Bill 2347 passes, moves to the floor. Representative Paluso will carry it. Thank you. Going to close the work session on House Bill 2347, and we're adjourned for the day. Thank you. 347, and we're adjourned for the day. Thank you.